In this podcast, I'm going to comment on or review a TV program which is on Australian TV called Stargazing Live. I say that again, Stargazing Live, with Professor Brian Cox. He's a celebrity astronomer from Britain, Julia Zemira, who's I suppose a cultural anchor, and a few other Australian personalities and stars, and they talk, well, I say TV celebrities, and over three nights they have a sort of community interactive live social media, I suppose documentary or interactive documentary, where people are looking up at the stars, sending in their shots from their telescopes, a whole lot of basic amateur telescope involved in looking at the various stars and planets, and basic information is being given over TV. And it's great for kids to basically look and listen to, and lots of bits of information coming across. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. In this case, I've slowly ramped up my ability to do podcasting, comment and speak. That's part of my cardiac rehabilitation, and it's one of these great opportunities that now that you can podcast, you can actually go see a program, podcast away, and get the information out and quickly, so it's still relevant. So it'll be relevant to people in Australia who are watching the TV program. But it's also perhaps relevant to people who can listen in to what's been shown and some of my comments on basic improvements or things that I saw which could have a little bit more science in, or have a slightly different approach on. Now I'm going to start off with scales of the universe. Now, I've previously podcasted on my favourite scale of the sun, at least. Our local solar system is 1 to a trillion. So the sun is 1,230,000 kilometres across, or 1.23 million kilometres across. It's 153 million kilometres from us, and on those sorts of scales, where the precise width of our planet Earth is roughly 4 pi 1,000 kilometres across. But if you select a scale of 1 to a trillion, everything reduces down. A million kilometres is 1 millimetre, so the sun contracts to 1.23 millimetres, like the size of a small cashew on the top of your cupcake. And the Earth is 153, or half a rule length away, and Pluto on that scale, as we've found out, is 6 meters away, and our nearest star is 47 or thereabouts kilometers away. And it's that last thing which is the gobsmacking thing, that 47 kilometers away at that scale is a very long distance. If the Earth is just about a handspan away from the sun, depending if you've got a large adult hand, it'll be roughly that. It's sort of, you know, that is a mind-blowing thing. Now, what happened in the program, they selected the scale of 1 to a billion. And 1 to a billion, everything's now 1,000 times. 1 to a trillion is a million million. 1 to a billion is 1,000 million scale. Now, selecting that gives a certain distance. The sun is a large beach ball at this stage. In this was a metal shaped in a rough sphere. I think it was shown at the start, and as a prop, so you knew what was there. And then the planets appropriately are small marble sizes, rather than, in this case, hundreds and thousands or millions and billions. So it's a different scale, and you have the distance of the solar system in that scale is a staggering distance. So they put the ball in, and eventually they have to get on the car and drive a million kilometres, or sorry, not a million kilometres, 6 kilometres away to get to Pluto. Look, very interesting, but I myself really thoroughly recommend the 1 to a trillion one, because it starts to give you a feeling for the size the galaxy and the other real estate which you see outside your telescope. I still think it's my worthwhile thing to go. Another point is sort of a commentary, and this is what it is, a commentary on showing the sun. They said the outer region of the sun is the corona. Now, really technically, if you're speaking, it's the photosphere and chromosphere. The corona is more like a feature which is seen in an eclipse. So there's, I'd say, possibly a slight confusion there. And then the commentary that it's only when the NASA satellite came out that you could see the chromosphere. Now, you can actually really see the chromosphere with in a standard telescope with a filter, red line hydrogen filter. And indeed, there has been previous photographs of tornadoes. It's not the very first tornado seen. And then the description of the sun with different field rotation rates. This is rotation 25-day rotation in the center and 35-day at the poles, leading to a twisting of the sun. It just stopped a little bit short. It showed it didn't really pull it forward to say the increased solar activity as it the actual field lines drag up, and then this is resolved by the field lines becoming chaotic on the surface of the sun, solar maximum, and the north and south pole reoriented itself. Now, this point wasn't necessarily made. And then there was a comment that the sun is a plasma and a liquid. Now, this is one point where you're teaching young kids, and effectively you've got two zones: the convective zone, which is a gas or effectively liquid. It's got hydrodynamics and flow of matter. The thing is, what we associate with a liquid, if I pour a glass of water on the table, the water will flow away. But if I have, say, a jelly, I put it on the table, it won't flow. You can push yourself through it. So the centre of the sun, I would say, is sort of like a very dense jelly. It's there, but there's no current inside it. That's in the radiative zone. There's no convection. And it could quite be easily explained, that aspect of the tachosphere and the generation of the magnetic field, as you have the radiation zone, center, two-thirds of the sun, rotating at a fixed, like a fixed solid ball, and the outer as a liquid rotating at different speeds, and this shear layer at the tachosphere causes the magnetic field. So that wasn't necessarily well explained. It's a fairly easy point to put across, and of course I'm saying this in a podcast, so it's probably something I can get across to possibly send it off to ABC. But in general, I think I have sent comments from time to time to people, and if you send a very oblique, small comment, yes, you get a response. But if it's a deeper analytical comment referring to papers and analysis, look, I'm sure it gets lost in all the other kooky people out there, but we'll see. That's not true. If you want to go in and research or talk to people at Princeton Plasma Physics Laboratory, PPL, and various things like that, or go into the papers, you're invited to do it yourself. And of course, there's a tendency that if they're the presenters, they're on stage, anything else which sounds as though you also want to be on stage is sort of understandable, and oh, no thanks. And this is a general problem in terms of the person who grabs the microphone for any particular topic. It seems very strangely difficult to add comments at a certain level. They're sort of gradient level. They've got themselves up and the public down and the government behind them. And sort of any peer-to-peer comments are very difficult. And if I can give a few examples of that, I was speaking with the entomologists who were doing a public display, and the more junior people who were working saw me fold up an aluminium ant and explain how it was done. They were very enthusiastic, but there was still an icy wall when it went up and saying, oh, hey, this should we adopt this innovation or method of teaching? And in general, it's sort of understandable. I really understood the academic, because I was... if I hadn't been thinking in that very much same area, I believe that, say, if I was in my laser physics day, met someone who was talking about laser physics, oh, I don't know. I can sort of understand. And so there are many areas. In quantum physics, we've got a big quantum physics push. I'm just, I suppose, will eventually speak to people, try and put it across. But it's, you're very much aware that your authority is up there, and you can't sort of really add additional information to an authority. Say in quantum physics, I perhaps would like to add 2 cents worth, but you know realistically it's not going to go through. So in GAIN, in this case, where I have the scale or the deeper understanding, and it's not my understanding, it's just you just have to read the papers and work your way through it. And translate it into a popular belief. So there's a sort of a popular belief thing, which is, oh, I don't know, 10, 20 years behind. It hasn't been really upgraded. There's another aspect with the solar wind, is that there's 2 different speeds of solar wind, and these 2 different speeds interact, creating shock waves of solar wind. So the solar wind is on again, off again, a fair after it passes the orbit of Earth by that time, and forms a rotating spiral. It's sort of like this fantastic... spiral in coffee or yogurt, but in 3-dimensional scale. It's an incredibly complicated and beautiful thing, and the solar wind blows up and blows a bubble around space, around us. So it's all this great. And the other intense thing is that the solar wind is actually evacuating this space. It's thinning out the solar atmosphere such that we can orbit inside. If that solar wind fails, our star becomes a red giant and engulfs us inside the sun. The other important thing is that the solar wind is peeling away the surface of the sun, so we can see a certain depth inside the sun. This is all the suns that we can see, which are not red giants, have basically got a solar wind potato peeler peeling down, not to the core, but through the photosphere. And so the actual temperature of the sun that we see, the 6,000 degrees or 5,700 degrees Kelvin that you can see pushed in there, is a function of the magnetic field peeling down so we can see a certain depth. So if that magnetic field fails, the sun will grow in radius and the outer radius will cool down. It'll have the same power output, but it's the smaller radius, bluer sun. Combination. I don't know how you can communicate that by a method of going up. So the important thing is that the where we are in the atmosphere, effectively in the atmosphere of the sun, as the situation has as it's cooled down. So this understanding of the solar wind and the solar wind switching off and us going to a red giant or planetary or going to the planetary nebula. A stage is an important thing to try and understand, a very easy concept to get across. My other sort of comment is that the cheap $100 telescope, which is given to people, there's several thoughts I do have about that. The Dobsonian mount is a story that really should be told, because I think Dobsonian Dobson was, I think I actually met the guy in Tasmania. Sorry, the same guy's out the back having exercises on podcasting. You must think I'm absolutely mad. So he was in San Francisco, Dobson. G'day, mate. Showing stars, I think, maybe to homeless people in general, and so decided to make a telescope mount, which is simpler. So rather than this complex where you have to align your create an artificial axis with the axis of the Earth, and so the telescope rotates in sympathy with the Earth in a simple way. This Dobsonian mount is more like the way that you mount a cannon, so to speak. It's more like putting a gun. Now, the thing is that it's easy to set up if you're only going to watch a planet for a few seconds and it's going to drift out of view, so it's rather complicated to point, so it's a cheaper mount. However, the important thing is that with the advent of computers, you can put a motor on both edges and the computers can work out how to move the telescope precisely to track it. There's stories also about software you can put between or on the camera output derived from citizen science, sort of aping the discoveries made to stabilize the space telescopes. That information has come through. So that's very interesting, probably an explanation of what infrared and what ultraviolet is, a short discussion of black body radiation. Of course, some of my podcast discussions to teach basic astronomy would be great in there. In terms of ways to try and explain the total number of stars by, say, having a pile of sand would be a great way of explaining that. And of course, the rotation of the galaxies, as we know, from previous podcasts, is a bit more complex, quarter of a billion years to rotate, but our passage is 100,000 or 2.5 times greater than the rotation speed, so the actual structure of our galaxy, density waves, and we travel through the density waves, and this really impacts on human history by sending, or Earth's history by sending us through ice ages, galactic ice ages, as we chill off, as we go in the darker section between arms, as we sail between the arms. We get apparently less cosmic radiation cooking our atmosphere, letting things go down. One of the interesting things I'd sort of like to finish off and part with is that the presenters were very, very cold. Now, if we follow again another one of my podcasts, the reason that they're cold is that the carbon dioxide, which is so good at trapping in heat, that they're basic thermal radiators, and so the carbon dioxide in our atmosphere radiates out our heat and starts to cool our Earth down to the temperature of the cosmic microwave background. So if they're cold, it's because we are actually feeling the cold of space. And of course, as the heating of effect of the Earth and the heating effect of the ozone peaks out, we get the thermopores up in the upper atmosphere at the end of the stratosphere thermocline. Is the area of the ozone layer. As that runs out, we get to minus 100 degrees C as there's no more carbon dioxide, and we really cool down. But it's an important thing to say is that cold that they're feeling the cold of space. That's just an intense thing to know. So that's a series of comments from Peter Hill Explains. And the objective of this is to be able to, having built up podcast speed and accuracy without thinking, I've just watched the program without thinking ahead, I've just data dumped all this information and comment. And again, the issue is these comments will go nowhere. It's a audio comment, and it won't go nowhere simply because a podcast can't be listened to, can't be processed. It can't be processed because a system of managing talent will automatically switch off other talent, talent going into it, or other suggestions going into it. It's there's a number of reasons for it. There's a circuitous route to go through peer review and comment, and the actual commentary that comes out through popular science has got a pretty funny origin, but it also speaks to a general broadband commitment to astronomy and science through Cosmos magazine, Star and Telescope magazine, organisations, and indeed the ABC. The interesting thing is that having seen or tried to organise community groups with money to build telescopes, and seeing telescope groups come in and lecture to the community, to see what how that's stopped. And incredibly, when we do have the money and the ability to set up telescopes in schools, internal politics in the education department, the state teachers and stuff like that, are suspicious and they cut it down. So this is a story which I've had unique insight to as a negotiator to get community groups and astronomers together, and also see teacher groups going across. I'm sitting here with no in a school grounds with no telescope, even though we had the money to produce it. And myself, there was a telescope in the local high school, and that really got me into science. I used to go up there with my trike, and believe it or not, in the late 70s, or so the early 70s when this happened. It's free at 8 o'clock at night. You can let your six-year-old get on that trike and just trike up to the local telescope. And the people there basically taught me hands-on astronomy. So there's many aspects to this. There's the big Twitter-oriented social media big process of astronomy, but there's another. If you look at the entire astronomy ecosystem, there's other aspects of general astronomy that can't get going due to levels of thinking. My actual belief is that schools and libraries should have telescopes as loan library equipment. So if someone gets interested in astronomy, they can loan a telescope for a certain time. That being said, I'll do another podcast about some really spectacular community astronomy, which will blow everyone's mind. It will absolutely blow your mind when I get to that. But for now, I have to continue my cardiac walk and continue searching ahead, trying to do podcasts. Thanks for listening. This, again, is like a play review, like a commentary review. Thanks for listening. Keep on thinking science. Keep on doing science. And most of all, keep on teaching science, even though there's heaps of obstacles out there. Thanks for listening.